evening, everybody. I think we'll get started. Now, I think a large number of people in the room, but for those that I don't, I'm Christine Chinkin. I'm Professor of International Law here at the LSC and currently Acting Director of the Human Rights Centre. So, delighted to welcome you all here for the event tonight, which is hosted by the Department of Law, the Gender Institute, and the Mannheim Centre for Criminology, all here at the LSE. So, as you know, the topic for tonight and the panel discussion is the policing and prosecution of rape. What do we know, and how should our knowledge shape policy and practice? So the sort of pattern of this evening's events is that we'll first have a presentation by our first speaker on my far right, Professor Betsy Stanko, followed by comments and discussion by our other panellists, and then we hope there'll be some time for some discussion and questions afterwards. So what I'm going to do then is first introduce the speakers, hand over to Betsy, and then we've just decided we'll probably move down there so that we can watch her PowerPoint, come back, and then we'll have the other panellists. So first and foremost, on my far right is our main speaker, Professor Betsy Stanko, who's an academic, but an academic who works with government and in particular with the police, she's an honorary professor of law in the Centre of Criminology and Sociology, Royal Holloway, University of London, assistant director, planning and portfolio, Metropolitan Police Service, and is shortly to join the Mayor's Office on Policing and Crime as head of insight and evidence. Betsy is going to focus on the findings of her research on the policing and prosecution of rape. And I suspect many of you may have already had a preview of this, either on Channel 4 or through reading The Guardian on Saturday. So we feel especially honoured that we've got you in person. And thank you very much for coming tonight. So then we're going to have our three panellists on my... where's Louise gone?
Right next to me.
Right on the left. Immediately is Professor Louise Ellison. She's Professor of Law at the University of Leeds since 2003, with research focusing generally on victims, credibility assessment, witness preparation, and juries, and primarily in the context of sexual violence. Followed then by Martin on my immediate right. Martin Hewitt is Deputy Assistant Commissioner, Specialist Crime and Operations in the Metropolitan Police Service. And then, last but not least, Harriet Wistrich. Harriet is a solicitor with Bernberg, Pierce and Partners, considerable experience in bringing civil actions against the police on behalf of rape victims. And again, many of you, I'm sure, will have seen the coverage over the last 10 days or so relating to the case that was brought with respect to the taxi driver, War Boys. And I think you're going to be referring to, and I think we should all say congratulations to you on the success of that case. So without any more ado, I'll turn over to Professor Stanko and look forward to your presentation.
Okay, thanks very, very much for inviting me to open this discussion and debate. I think it's time that we had to reopen debates about rape and what it is and how it affects all of us as well. I think it's very timely in light of the discussion, particularly post-Savile, and the kinds of thinking and criticism and discussions that have gone on about Savile, which I think have not been applied to rape. So I'm going to try to apply some of that thinking that I've heard in the public domain to data, to information that I've looked at for the past 8 years. There's a number of people in the room who have helped with this research over the years. And so I thank them, my co-author, who I'm currently writing this particular piece up with. Katrin Hull is in the audience. And this work will be in the public domain and will be in academic articles. There was outrage and disgust in the UK over the past year when it was revealed that a knighted celebrity, Jimmy Savile, was found to be the most prolific rapist and sex offender never prosecuted. Allegations about the sexual predatory behavior of other celebrities and other infamous men have followed, with some convictions and high-profile acquittals. All of the convictions and all of the acquittals have had debate and discourse about what rape is. My purpose here is to underpin these debates with some empirical evidence aimed at raising the bar in the conversation to date. I'd like to ask some fundamental questions about the current capacity of law to understand the sexual understand the context of sexual violence as the starting point for considering how to proceed in a fair and open way to promise fair justice for allegations of rape. I am not calling, interestingly enough, for a new law on rape. I will not be bashing the police or the CPS or other decision makers, although I am challenging the legal logic at the heart of many process decisions for many rape allegations. For me, the issues here are too important to waste time blaming organizations, government, or the behavior of individuals. What I want is for us to think differently, step back, and reflect. We know that for rape allegations, the matters of credibility and consent saturate the landscape, and it's these that I wish to address. For those of you who don't know, I've worked for the past decade inside the Metropolitan Police Service, an organization that's never been too far from the headlines ever since I've been there. I have come to believe strongly over that decade that we all need good policing and that we deserve the best policing in a city as vibrant as London. The past 10 years have also seen considerable number of government body commission reviews, inspection reports, statistical bulletins, all to address the problem of the attrition of rape. Law reform has been tried. Improving victim care has been another step as well. We've had the growth of sexual assault referral centers and the introduction of sexual offenses investigative trained officers, SOATs, to attend rape and sexual assault cases. In many ways, you could say that London was the most innovative place in the world in terms of the way it's dealt with rape. You could say that. Whilst these improvements, legal changes, regular inspections, inquiries, and research reports are all generally welcomed, many commentators have expressed doubt as to their effectiveness in reducing attrition. So that's where I start. And I'm also starting in another place as well. Whoops, I forgot to even start. Sorry. Ha! Those of you who know me, I do those kinds of things. Is also just to say a brief word about the framework that I'm coming with in terms of addressing these issues. And this is that I also believe, and probably there is a lot of theory around procedural justice, that you need moral alignment between the way police and courts wield their power and the way in which the people believe that that power is fairly used. And that's very, very important. So part of this and part of my debate today is very much talking about, thinking about how we can be smarter about the way we talk about rape, rape law, rape practice, but we do so in a way that enables us to blame wrongdoing and not the victims. Okay, what do we know? And this is a quick, absolutely whistle-stop through. What do we know about rape? We know that it's largely, we know a lot about unreported rape. We know a lot about shame, blame, and naming. And we know about how effective shame, blame, and naming is. That's 3 decades of research. What do we know? We know the official statistics. Again, whistle stop. A lot of rape is about people that know each other. We know that it's gendered. And even the ONS now says in their official reports that gender is a key factor in the risk of sexual violence victimization. It's a fact. We know that offending is gendered. We know that it's also now highly recognized as a systematic weapon of war. We know that it's universal. But we still think it's largely considered to be a confusion around consent. As the official data says, 90%, 9 out of 10, I consider that a majority, of cases involve offenders who are known to their victims. Okay. What do we know about blame, shame, and naming? We know that it's internalized. Again, there's a lot of research that suggests this. There's a felt responsabilization. Blame for provocation, blame because of the situation. People blame themselves, women blame themselves for rape. It works. It largely works because the silence is great. However, one of the things I learned by going inside the Metropolitan Police, and I'm probably one of the few academics in the world that has ever worked for 10 years inside a police service, is that what we've not done is we have not done a study of, and we have not looked systematically at, what do we learn from the few who report? If I've been to one, I've been to hundreds of meetings where I'm told we don't need to know about what's reported, because it's such a small minority of the reality, that we don't need to learn from that, because it's only what's reported. So I've been studying what's reported for the last 8 years. And much of that time, and this is actually, I think, to the credit now of the Metropolitan Police, is that this work will now be in the public domain, and much of the kinds of debates and discussions that will happen in the public domain will be ones where they will be driven by the evidence and not by what people think is going on. I've been to many, many meetings that have been evidence-free zones. I can assure you. And what I'm also here to assure you is there actually is quite a lot of information that's very, very useful to start focusing where it is that we can start asking for and requiring improvement. Okay. This is official data. Oops, there seemed to be one before. There it is. Okay, what do the data say? The official data. Now, when Vivian Stern, Baroness Stern, completed her review in 2010, she recommended that the CPS, their work and output be reflected in official statistics. And that is that when they charge somebody, what's the outcome from that level? So that's one of the reasons why we have a conviction rate, an official conviction rate of 40%. And that does reflect the output, the work of the CPS. But I think it's important for us to look at what we also need to remember is this relatively flat line here. And so in terms of the overall proportion of convictions to reports, it's still relatively flat. That is, when somebody picks up the phone, walks into a police station, the outcome of that encounter is this one down here. What's happening now is there are more reports of rape. And we can talk about that later, but what I'm interested in at this point is, what are they? What kinds of rape is it? What is rape as seen from the lens of an official report? Okay. When you walk into a police station or you call up, there is a process that's sparked. And in order to keep yourself in that process, you need to go through a number of hurdles. And I'm like a rabbit running over things. So this is going to be a rapid fire. These are the kinds of things that you need to do. And whoa, stay in. I'll do that again because I like it. Because these are a number of hurdles. There are absolutely, you have to report, then it has to be recorded. So there's been a debate about no crimes. It needs to be recorded in action. It has to be then recorded and investigated. Then it has to be investigated, and they have to identify a suspect. Remember that a number of people are already known. In the Met, over 70 to 75% of the rapes that reported, victims know they're offenders. You have to have it recorded, investigated, identified, and arrested. Then you have to do the next. Then you have to, in other words, you have to stay with it. You have to stay with the decision-making process at every stage along the way. And in terms of keeping victims informed, this is actually quite an arduous process. It actually requires quite a lot of contact as well. And that's important. We know contact is quite important, but we also know that keeping each one of these things, giving the name, blaming, and shaming, can be disruptive in someone's life. Okay, what am I looking at? Over 3,500 rape allegations over 8 years. And I chose to do a 100% sample in 2 months rather than have anyone be concerned about the selection process. You just take everything during a period of time. So there's 100% during the months of April and May. The initial work was commissioned by Ian Blair when he was concerned about the differential treatment of rape allegations in different boroughs. So there has been what I would call an organizational history in terms of the conversation of this work. It started in 2005. You might have heard it referred during the Levinson inquiry as the Paddock Report, but it began by looking at in 2005. What I'm going to be showing you is 2012 because it is later, but also my wonderful geeky co-author can do things with data that we couldn't do even 8 years ago. That is that once you get a number of cases, we can start doing a much more sophisticated statistical analysis of outcomes in a way that wasn't even possible 8 years ago. But there are 3,500 cases, and there is a pattern, and it's fairly consistent. But just to give you a sense of what the data are, we have lots of information about who the victims are, lots of information about who the suspects are, including their history of criminality. We have lots of information about what the offense was and what it was about. And we have lots of variables about the police investigation. This is a very rich data set. It's also extraordinarily labor intensive, just to let you know. But it is also something that I think, in terms of public accountability, is something that enables law to be seen in a way that I don't think can be seen previously. Now, this data has been reported in the public domain before, but I also think that the significance of the vulnerability of victims has been noted but not noticed. What's interesting for me, again, looking at year after year after year, is the consistency of the findings in terms of who is reporting. Remember, this is not silenced rape victims. This is who is coming to the police to report rape. Who is coming to police to report? And think about kind of the context. What I would like you to do from my whistle stop through 3 decades of research is I want you to apply that to the categories that I'm talking about, because I'm not going to be very explicit about that here, but I'm assuming that you will be able to use some of that understanding of how naming and shaming and blaming works when you were young, works when you might have mental health and or learning disabilities, works when you have alcohol and drug misuse, and works when you are in a situation of domestic violence with your partner. The data in 2012 are better because, as we learned and as we went along over the 8 years, we began to be a bit better about coding, perhaps, but it's fairly consistent. When we say 90% of reported rape victims have some kind of those 4 vulnerabilities, and some of them have multiple vulnerabilities, you begin to see that the reported rapes, I keep coming back to that, the reported rapes means the pool of people in London, you're my city, in London, that are highly vulnerable before they even start. So remember that little rabbit warren that I asked people to go through? I like this. I'll do it again. Because this is really important to know, right? This one, that's just the process that we're expecting. Vulnerable victims to go through that process and be happy about it. Be committed to the process. This is what I call my ski slope. So over the 8 years, what we have is there has been some difference and some changes. There have been a lot of debates about whether things have been crimed or no crime, for example. And that might have made some difference. And there's a lot of time, people spend a lot of time on the debate between crime and no crime. I'm trying to move us along through the whole continuum, because actually that particular focusing solely on crime and no crime truncates the rest. And actually, my little rabbit warren, they only get through the top 2. We want them to get, you know, we're expecting people to go through the whole ski slope. I can come back to that later if you'd like. Okay. The top lines in terms of getting a sense is that one of the things that I've learned from this is reporting and starting a process doesn't mean you're going to stay in it, and sometimes you don't stay in it for very long. And that is, victims themselves decide to not cooperate with law. They withdraw. They withdraw because they don't answer their phone, they don't answer anything. They just disappear. They disappear. Not all of that can be blamed, and I'm going to put that on the police. Contact. It can't all be blamed on victims either. But it's a reality that we need to think about much more carefully. And so one of the things I'm thinking about in terms of conceptualizing that space is we keep talking about report as if it's you're crossing a threshold of silence. I'm suggesting that actually reporting a rape doesn't mean you cross anything. I mean, you've reported it, the police have recorded it, perhaps, but that doesn't necessarily mean you agree to that rabbit warren that you're going through. And 93% of this happens at the police investigation stage. If someone doesn't withdraw, then actually no crime does make a difference, a little bit more. And there is 47% of those cases, there is no further action. So about a little over a third of the reports that come to the police are referred to the CPS for a charge. And of the CPS, reduce that down another third before there is any look in slightly to a court of law. That's the ski slope. We do have, and we will have then, from outcome from charge to conviction. We're still chasing a few. So if you think of these cases in 2012, and there are still cases that are outstanding, think about that as the time to come to trial, because that may take another year and a half, 2 years. That's a long time in a rape case. This is why I love Catherine, because she can do these kinds of things. I asked her to tell me how I could explain this to my mother. This is what it says. Now, it's all bad, actually, is what it says. It's all bad. Everything is bad. Many of the features that we're looking at perhaps are actually the things that drive people to withdraw. So the blue is withdrawn. So it may be that even if a suspect is identified, somebody withdraws. Video recorded statement, they're less likely to withdraw, but they're still withdrawing. Known sex offender is still likely to withdraw, possibly. Those are less than one, so they're only like 50% more likely to withdraw. However, and this was deserves far more concern, if your victim is unclear about consent, and remember what I said about perhaps learning difficulties, somebody who might have used a lot of alcohol before, you're 600% more likely to have your case no-crimed. If you have learning difficulties, it's nearly 600 times more likely to have your case no-crimed. This is a very important finding, because one, it shows that it's bad overall, but it's worse for some. And this is why I've been raising questions about whether law at all is using the right stance to consider an allegation of rape. Because I started originally around credibility and consent. Credibility and consent are two really important features of a rape allegation. They're absolutely critical for anybody who's going to stand up in a court of law, articulately describe what happened, be able to say where that line is between coercion and consent, and be able to convince a jury or a judge and a judge that is the situation that you were describing. So the reason why I am having this discussion now is that we've got to do better than this. As far as I know, I think we can, but I think we need to do it in a different way. I am not a fan of changing the law. What I am, however, is trying to discover what might help more and what might not. Okay, so what we know is what detracts from legal justice outcome is a history of consensual sex, voluntary alcohol consumption, again, using our statistical geeky model, how wonderful is that? An inconsistent victim account, breakdown in communication between victim and officer. So we might want to do, that might be something we could do, and that's one of the discussions we are having in the Met about this kind of stuff. And a lack of understanding of consent, but many of these things are about the vulnerability of victims. What influences a better outcome? Haven attendance, interestingly enough. Independent evidence, and we also have talked about that, although independent evidence in the light of over 70% of the incidents happening in a victim's or offender's homes, which is, again, known from the data. We know this as a fact. Evidence that the victim resisted or provided an acceptable account of resistance, and a video recorded statement, and that's about investigation. It is something you can do something about. Okay, these are the, in listening to the discussion around U-Tree, which is the Saville inquiry, the following kinds of observation were made by the NPCC and the Metropolitan Police. Whilst the NPCC helpline was contacted by some people who had previously reported their concerns and wished to alert authorities again, the majority of people had never spoken about their experiences to the authorities until now. The reasons cited for this were varied and included the fear of not being believed, and a lack of trust in statutory agencies, or the feeling that the justice system would be ineffective in prosecuting the offender. According to victims' accounts, offenses were mainly opportunist sexual assaults, many situations manipulated by Saville himself. But there are others where there was an element of grooming or planning is said to have occurred. When the recorded crimes there are 126 indecent acts and 34 rape and penetration offenses. Of reported offending by Saville, 73% was against those aged under 18 years old. The total victim age range of those who came forward between 8 and 47 years old at the time of the abuse. Of those, 82% were female, and most were in the 13 to 16 age group. Now, while there are some differences between that description and what I've just showed you in terms of the kinds of rapes that are reported to the Metropolitan Police, what I'm suggesting is we need to not separate what happened in Saville from what's happening today. We cannot have that kind of debate. We have got to have a different kind of debate, and therefore the challenge for us as practitioners, as law professors, as activists, is to find a way of getting around what we know to be great barriers. I do think rape is not the same as burglary. There is no evidence that it is. And as somebody who believes in evidence, then I suggest we need to think differently about what that means. So, having sat on this for 8 years, I have some thoughts about what that might be. First, I would suggest that actually investigating, knowing that there is a likelihood to be a presumption of that the victim is vulnerable, will make a difference in the way that you go about your investigation. What that means is that we need to investigate how the offender has exploited vulnerability, not managed consent. Because exploiting vulnerability tells me something different. It's a difference in discourse, it's a difference in evidence, it's how you gather the evidence, it's how you enable a victim to speak about what they've experienced. I've also learned after 10 years inside the Metropolitan Police that actually right now I'm experiencing greater transparency than I ever have. And I think that's an opportunity, because I think actually transparency enables a conversation in a way that is much more open than it has been in the past. And to talk about, you know, what kind of criminal justice outcomes that we can have, what kind of justice outcomes can we have for sexual violence? We talk about, you know, rape and war as having perhaps an access to the an international criminal court, but very few cases have ever been tried in a criminal court internationally. And the other is, I now know that it's possible for law to have empirical outcome information. It is very difficult because the way in which data are gathered are not easily render themselves to analysis. I mean, having, I know this is going to sound a bit geeky, but having an identifier that enables you to match a crime report with a CPS outcome would make my life so much easier. Because actually, it's important to see what the outcome is. If you were a business, or actually, the analogy I'm using now, if you were a surgeon and your expertise was breast cancer, you could use that analogy for rape. And you said, oh, it's okay, I think we might be able to do this, but actually the outcome is that I have a 6% survival rate. Is that good for you? We would go, no way. But I think in many ways it's time for us to begin to say to justice, we want to know what the outcomes are. That's important, because actually we demand that everybody gets better in order to improve what that might be. I know it sounds a bit idealistic, but that's okay. I can take that one at the moment. So I believe that we can actually do far, far better after 10 years of being able to work with data on the inside of an organization and between organizations in a way that enables them to see differently what they do and how they do it and where it breaks. So I'm thinking that I'm probably... No, that's my 30 minutes, right? I've done it. So that's really what I wanted to say. what I want us to be able to talk about here is we have the information. I think it says that we're not doing a very good job across the board. It's not just the police's fault. It's not just the prosecutor's fault. It is, what I hear is, it's driven by, we need to know something about credibility, and we need to have high credibility in order to proceed, or better credibility in order to proceed. We think it's something about consent, but the problem is that by the time you even pick up the phone or go to the police station, you're in such a disadvantage before you start that actually it's got to be something else. And I think it's time to talk about what that else is. That's it. I'm gonna put my little, I'm gonna keep our little things up. I like it. I think. I'm not sure how to make it big, but.
Thank you very much indeed for a very impressive whistle-stop tour through 10 years worth of research and some very important conclusions. So thank you, Betsy. So now we'll turn straight to our panellists. So, Louise.
Thank you. And I'd like to use the time available to me to say a little bit more about case outcomes in cases involving complainants with mental health conditions. As with the generous support of Professor Stansko and also the support of the Metropolitan Police Service, my co-researchers, Katrin Hall, popular lady, Paul Willang, who's in the audience, and Vanessa Munro and I, have specifically set out to reanalyse some of the rape allegation data collected by the Metropolitan Police Service to specifically examine what happens in cases involving complainants with mental health difficulties. They represent a sizeable proportion, as Betsy's already indicated, of rape allegations, at least in the in London. And I think those results are worth recounting. Our particular sample related to April and May in 2012. Now, in short, in line with what Professor Stansko has already indicated, the picture that emerges from this data is largely consistent with that is depicted in the pre-existing literature, suggesting that allegations by complainants with mental health difficulties are significantly and substantially more likely to suffer attrition. Specifically, our results indicate that these complainants are more likely, significantly more likely to see their cases no-crimed, and significantly more likely to see cases dropped through police decisions to no further action. Key intermediate milestones in police investigations, such as suspect identification and arrest, are significantly less likely to be reached in these cases. And the pattern then carries on at later stages. So these types of complainants are less likely to see their case referred to the CPS for a decision, and in turn the CPS is less likely when cases involve complaints of mental health conditions as opposed to those that don't, are less likely to charge. In seeking to account for these case outcomes, we, Katrin, drilled further into the data and observed that complaints with mental health difficulties were, as a group, significantly more likely to display a range of characteristics which the research literature tells us both heightens vulnerability to sexual victimisation, but also simultaneously appears to reduce credibility, perceived credibility. So complainants with mental health difficulties were, for example, significantly more likely to also have intellectual disabilities, were also more likely to have drug or alcohol dependency issues, were more likely to be homeless or to be identified as missing persons, were more likely to have previously reported sexual victimisation to the police. Then when we looked at the type of the nature of the allegations themselves, we found that cases involving complainants with recorded mental health difficulties were more likely also to display a range of characteristics which potentially contradict notions of the so-called real rape, and once again, lessen credibility. So more specifically, something that Betsy's already touched upon, complainants with mental health difficulties were significantly less likely than those without to engage in physical resistance, and we've seen how important that is, and I know from my own research how important that is, seemingly from a juror's perspective, were less likely to provide a consistent account when they reported the offence to the police, were significantly more likely to appear under the influence of drugs or alcohol at the time of reporting the incident, although less likely to have consumed alcohol at the time of the alleged offence. So in sum, this is snapshot data. It has its limitations, But it does provide very valuable insights. I would echo what Professor Stanko said in this regard, very valuable insights into the multiple vulnerabilities of a significant number of rape complainants. And that is something that I know we've suspected as much, is something that hasn't really been the focus of the literature around attrition and rape. It also, of course, raises key questions about equal access to justice, and it also raises important questions regarding non-discrimination. Now, happy to ask some more questions about our data in relation to that, but something that we were particularly struck by, something I also want to say something about, as a research team when we were looking at the research in this area, is the substantial gaps in our knowledge and understanding about contemporary criminal justice responses to complainants with mental health difficulties and indeed a whole host of vulnerabilities. The title of today's session is Policing and Prosecuting Rape, What We Know and How We Should Respond. But what we're particularly struck by and what we found particularly troubling and problematic is just how much we don't know. I've made a long list. I won't share it all. but for example, we know very little at present about the extent to which criminal justice practitioners, police officers, prosecutors, judges consider themselves adequately equipped to firstly identify complainants with vulnerabilities, including mental health problems, and feel themselves equipped to then adequately handle these types of cases. There's some evidence in the research literature about inadequate training and problems in that regard. This is not an issue that has ever received close scrutiny. Similarly, the ways in which mental health problems and other vulnerabilities, drug dependency, repeat victimisation, intellectual disability, etc., how those are seen to detract potentially from complainant credibility is again something that we know very little about, and the consequent impact that that has on decision making at each stage of the criminal process. There's a substantial literature on the woeful stigma and discrimination that those with mental health issues face, and also about the substantial misunderstandings that surround mental distress, misconceptions and myths that also pertain to those with intellectual disabilities. The whole host of misunderstandings, but what we don't know is how far those misconceptions and myths actually then feed into credibility assessments and reliability-based judgments that are under key decisions that are taken by the police, the CPS, the courts, ultimately by juries. Staying with credibility evaluation, we know very little about the information sources that police prosecutors rely upon when forming reliability assessments, credibility evaluations, and deciding whether to crime, record, or proceed with a prosecution. And while, as Betsy has rightly said, there have been significant strides in recent years in improving the treatment of vulnerable witnesses, I'm thinking there about special measures, increased specialisation in terms of the police, the prosecution, the judiciary, the introduction of independent sexual assault advisors, SARCs, etc., etc. Very welcome developments. At the same time, we also know very little about the perceived sufficiency, adequacy of the support and protection that are afforded to vulnerable rape complainants at each stage of the criminal process. This is something we still know very little about. I won't go on. I could go on. But one more, just because this is the one that keeps me awake at night. We know incredibly little about the scale of victimisation in institutional settings. There's some worrying evidence out there. But the rate of sexual victimisation that occurs in residential care homes and also indeed on psychiatric wards is something that we know very little about. And there's very little information about criminal justice responses in those types of cases. Indeed, we know very little about how many of these offences are actually ever reported, ever come to the attention of the criminal justice system. These are all hugely important questions, I think we probably all agree, but the existing research base actually tells us strikingly little, provides very few answers in regards to anything. There isn't a consequence in stark terms. It simply is impossible to say at present whether a substantial population of hugely vulnerable rape complainants are indeed receiving fair, just and appropriate treatment at the hands of the criminal justice system, or whether, as critics fear, that a combination of inadequate support and or attitudinal barriers are operating to deny complainants with mental health issues and a range of other vulnerabilities an equal chance to secure justice. So to echo what Professor Stanko has said, you know, we do know quite a bit, and we know a lot more, thanks to Betsy and Katrin, we know a lot more than we did, but there are still substantial gaps in our knowledge, and there is therefore, I think, an urgent need. Last thing I'll say, since we're next time. There is an urgent need for fuller and more contextualised, evaluative study of contemporary criminal justice responses to rape allegations made by complainants with mental health difficulties and indeed all manner of vulnerabilities. If we are to start crafting appropriate solutions, we first need to know both the nature of the problem and the full extent of the problem. And at present, we don't.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. So turn directly to Martin.
Okay. Just my role within the police service outside the Metropolitan Police, I've got the national lead for looking at adult sexual offences and have had that for the last couple of years. And I'm familiar with Betsy's work and want to just kind of talk about some of those issues, reinforce some of the issues that Betsy's made and indeed that Louisa's just made. The issue for me that we're talking about here is about access to justice and whether people who are the victims of sexual offences have access to justice in the way that others do. And Betsy describing it's different to a burglary, I would agree entirely with. And I think as you move into greater degrees of vulnerability, that opportunity to have access reduces because of a whole range of factors. And I want to just talk a little bit about some of those. There is no getting away from the fact that for the police service, there's a painful history in terms of investigating rape. Whether you go back as far as the mid-80s and the Thames Valley programme that Roger Grafe made, or whether you come right up to date and you talk about the failings in cases like War Boys that Harriet will talk about, we have a real challenge in terms of the service of convincing and getting public confidence that we will deal effectively with this. And that's really an important aspect that I'll come back to a couple of times. But there is equally a broader, and I think this is part of what Betsy's trying to say in terms of broadening the debate, there is a broader societal issue about attitudes to rape that are played out in all the public, and the public become juries, and the public become police officers, and the public are in the media. And all of those kind of so-called rape myths, which are so prevalent and so strong and so passed on generationally, that affect the attitudes of everybody as they come into this kind of process. And I talk a lot about rape at various things, and almost always the title of my presentation is Changing the Debate, because I entirely agree with Betsy that we have got to get away from a place where we're targeting individual aspects of the process or the system, and we need to get to understand why does the problem exist in the way it does, and why is it that our system is not adequate to give everybody equal access to justice, which is surely what we should be aiming for. I think Savile did open up the debate. I think some of that has regressed a little with recent cases, but one of the phrases that we used a lot around the time of Savile was exactly what Betsy said, which is what that represented was power meeting vulnerability. The power was different in different cases. I think the point that Louise has made about institutions, I would go further and say organisations, where the nature and the character of an organisation has allowed offending to take place, or it's either hidden it or it's in some cases encouraged, and that's something that we're trying to look at. So I get the vulnerability aspect, and we've done a lot of practical things within the service to try and address those needs of the victim, and many of them have been spoken about. The sexual offence investigative trained officers who are there specifically to try and deal with the needs of the victim and to understand that vulnerability and try and mitigate that vulnerability. the sexual assault referral centres and the video interviews and the access to medical support and psychological support and counselling support, which is so important. We have, in most places in the country, dedicated investigators to deal with these offences because of the challenges that I'll come on to talk about and others have already mentioned of doing that, and much, much better joint working with the CPS. There's a really important point to make when we start talking about statistics of how many people go through the system. And in all those stages I've just spoken about, one of the things that we absolutely have to take into account is we cannot and we will not force a victim to go further into that system. We cannot take the power away again, in my opinion, from a victim. And so everything that we do in that environment is done with the express permission and agreement of the victim. And that's a really important point that I think we have to make, because you need to put that into perspective when we talk about the figures. We police in a real world, and Betsy talked about the data that she has around those that report. The reality is, depending on how you want to look at the data, 75% or more of people don't report. That's a massive issue of concern to me. A, because it means that I don't understand the true nature of sexual offending in London. I know 25% or so, that we do get some other sources. So we've got to do as much as we can, A, to get people to report, but B, to also understand that without necessarily people reporting. And 2/3 drop out from our part of the process, which Betsy has talked about. The name, blame and shame aspect, and what a victim is trying to process about their offence, is such a critical factor in that. And that takes you back into all of that bit that I said about the societal bit. It takes you about the bit that is the reason, in most cases, that victim has been chosen by the offender is because of those vulnerabilities. That's why they've selected that victim, and those vulnerabilities play out throughout the entire system. And there is also, I think, a real fear of the criminal justice process. And there was certainly some research last year, Ministry of Justice research, which talked a lot about people's fear of what that process is going to do. A process that's going to take further control away from you. A process that, in essence, if you characterise it, is you as the victim are put on trial in a process to prove your credibility rather than necessarily all the attendant circumstances. And then when you look at some of the media reporting that we've had fairly recently around some of the big cases where victims are either forgotten or to some extent vilified, and quite recently, certainly in the last 3 or 4 months, we've had, you know, 3 suicides by victims who either didn't feel that the investigation was good enough in one case, or in 2 cases that the criminal justice process was quite so damaging to them. So we need to be real about that. The attrition that Betsy talked about, my favourite of her slides is the one that takes you through all those different elements of the process, because I think what it does, it just gives a fairly graphic illustration of just how complex and how sort of multi-stage that process is. And we're expecting a victim to stay with us, to stay with the CPS, to stay with the process all the way through when they have gone through what will invariably be a deeply traumatic experience. And so they're trying to process that as a human being on the one level, and we are trying to process that through what is by necessity a legal process. And that match is quite challenging. So the vulnerability of the victims plays into that. And I think one of the other unique aspects of rape is the extent to which a successful prosecution is resting on the shoulders of the victim. It's very rarely the case in other offences where there will often be independent evidence that we can draw on, independent witness evidence, independent other physical evidence. In sexual offences cases, the requirement in our system of the victim to establish their credibility and then all the other facts is I think unique in terms of the challenges that presents for them individually and for prosecutors and for investigators and for the process to actually deal with. And I really do have concerns around the whole public confidence issue. Now, some of that public confidence issue is driven by mistakes that we make, and we will make mistakes. These are incredibly complex, and challenging victims, incredibly complex investigations, and sometimes we will get those wrong. And when quite rightly, the mistakes that we made are made public, then that has a negative impact on victim confidence. But I think some of the backdrop and some of the rhetoric and the quite vitriolic comments that you see around some of the cases that have happened recently, and particularly some of the high-profile and more historic cases, is really deeply unhelpful in terms of trying to get people out there. Someone sitting out there now who had an offence committed against them last night, and you think what the backdrop is about whether I decide, am I going to take that incredibly brave step and go forward to the police, with all that you would be imagining about what that process is going to entail for you. So we've got to do everything that we can do around that. So just to sort of summarise, what it comes back to is access for justice. And to my mind, as we currently have the system, I'm like Betsy, I don't think it's about changing law. We often try and change laws, and I'm not sure it always helps. It's about getting a process that understands the challenges that the victim, the investigators, the prosecutors face to actually successfully take this through the process. The points that Louise made about train people at every stage of that is really important. But it cannot be right that we have a type of crime where I would argue that the victim's access to justice is less than it is in many other types of crime. And if you then look at a victim with additional vulnerabilities, and the example I always use is if you are a sex worker. So if you are a sex worker who has been raped and you report that rape, which is a pretty challenging thing to do in the first place when you think of the most a sex worker relationship with police and authority, and then it finally gets to a court, and the experience for a sex worker having to carry that prosecution or that case through a court and all the challenge that will go around that person's life and that person's credibility. And we've got to get to a place where there are not deemed to be grades of victim. And I think that's what we have in rape at the moment. We have grades of victim dependent on the circumstances in which that person suffered their offence. So from a policing point of view, we've got to do everything we can do to increase confidence. I think we can do, when you understand that vulnerability assessment, there's much that we can do about preventing. Because actually, whilst a lot of this is about, we're talking about getting it through a system, what I actually want to do is prevent people being raped. And I think our understanding of the vulnerability allows us to do more of that. We've got to raise our standards, and we've got to get consistency, and we've got to minimise the number of times where we make tragic mistakes, because that all impacts on the confidence. And I think there is more data out there now. We quite recently, as part of the Rape Monitoring Group, put a lot more data out into the public arena, and we will continue to do that, and we'll continue to do that with richer data so that the debate starts. But to go back to the very beginning, what I think Betsy's trying to start and what I would absolutely support is we've got to get to a broader society debate about what the nature of this crime is, why this crime is happening, why we still don't have people who understand consent, because we don't have an understanding of consent, and then how we get to a system collectively that allows us to support those victims, if that's the right thing to do, through to a successful prosecution. Because ultimately what I want to do is lock up people who rape people, and we need to do, the more that we can do of that, the better, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you very much indeed. And so, Harriet, now I'll turn to you.
Okay, thank you. Well, I'm going to talk a bit about some things that came out of the case that I did, which I'm not sure if everyone was aware of it, but it was called DSD and MBV against the Commissioner of Police in Metropolis, and there was a judgment a week before last, which basically... Sorry.
Is that better like that? Yeah.
There was a judgment last week which basically found that there was a series of systemic failures by the Metropolitan Police which amounted to a violation of the investigative duty of the police under Article 3 of the European Convention on Human Rights. And that's actually quite a significant judgment, because previously, we've had a lot of case law, which goes back to a case called Hill against West, Chief Constable of West Yorkshire, which says that the police are essentially immune from suit in negligence. So you cannot sue the police if they fail to investigate a crime. It's never been possible before in English law, but but now there is a sort of a bit of an opening, and I think that's a very important opening. And I want to say a bit about what happened, what came up in the case. I'd like to start by saying also that I share everyone's, I think, expressed the view, but it's not about the law of rape that's the problem. And what came up very strongly to me in this case was actually the law was fine. The policies of the Metropolitan Police Sapphire Unit were excellent. This case concerned drug-assisted sexual assault. It was about the taxi driver who drugged all the women and assaulted them in the taxi. The policies are very good. And the number one principle in the standard operating procedure, which we kept coming back to throughout the case, principle one, it is the policy of the Metropolitan Police Service to accept allegations made by any victim in the first instance as being truthful. An allegation will only be considered as falling short of a substantial allegation after a full and thorough investigation. And that is absolutely the right way to investigate rape. You have to start by accepting a victim's account, and you work with that victim until the point at which something comes up that's so over the top and extraordinary that you have to start seeing if you can pull that one apart, and maybe this person isn't telling the truth. But that's the way that you should start by investigating rape. Now, what was astonishing in this case? We know that ultimately 105 victims came forward. This was after the media appeal, after the eventual successful trial. And there are probably many more who never came forward. So we don't know how many actual victims of this serial rapist there were. But and we also know, and this sort of came clear in the evidence, that 10 women reported War Boys before he was eventually caught. Two of the women were my clients, the claimants in the case, and both of those women, I don't know how the other women felt they were treated by the police, but both of those women felt that the police just didn't believe them. They made complaints throughout the investigatory process. So initially they were taken seriously, but very quickly, after, I think the SOET officers were quite good, but after that, when the specialist detectives came on board, suddenly the whole case seemed to fall apart. And both those women, I mean, the first victim is one of the first of War Boys' victims, kept complaining, saying, "You're not believing me. Why aren't you speaking to this witness? Why aren't you doing that?" And eventually, when she was told they were dropping the case, She just said, "Look, you can keep the evidence because he's going to do this again," and that was quite a shocking thing that turned out to be true. And this woman, I don't know if any of you saw any of the news coverage, but she did actually do the interview on the Channel 4 program, and what she said was that she felt she lived for 10 years with this terrible guilt that somehow, because the police didn't believe her, she was responsible for all these other women that got raped. So it's not just about blaming yourself for getting yourself raped. It's also about blaming yourself for all the other women that were raped. And that was awful. I just couldn't quite understand it at the time. And I remember when the second woman came along, who was one of his later victims, and I thought, great, we've got two women, and that'll be really good. They can support each other. And the first one said, "Please don't let me meet her. I don't want to meet her." She just, she couldn't bear to be in the same space as her because she felt terrible responsibility that this woman had got raped because the police didn't believe her. Now, what's perhaps the most shocking thing of all for me in this case was that after War Boys was eventually convicted, there was an internal Met Police kind of investigation into failings, the Operation Danzy report, which identified a series of failings about the investigation. And there was also an IPCC report, which also kind of showed up a lot more failings. And there was quite a big outcry after the IPCC report was published about the extent of the failings in this particular investigation. But actually, the IPCC report only touched the side, we discovered by the time we got through the trial, and the judge in the judgment actually says that both those reports were very deficient and missed out all sorts of things. But the thing that shocked me the most was that after these two reports, and after, you know, some disciplinary action was taken, the police officer who actually were called to give evidence by the police in November last year didn't seem to feel responsible at all for their failures. They didn't feel responsible for all these women that may have got raped because they messed up the investigation. In fact, one of them was incredibly arrogant, and I actually made a note of some of his evidence because I think it's interesting to hear. His name is Detective Inspector Stephen Underwood, and I think he's still I'm not sure if he still works within the rape investigation, but he's certainly still a detective inspector, and he was questioned. This is the second case, which was in 2007, and this was in Plumstead Police Station, which was later shown to be one of the police stations where they were trying to know crime, everything, or reduce everything to crime-related incidents. And he was quite, you know, he was quite candid about the fact that this particular case was quickly reclassified as a crime-related incident, and that was very important because in terms of Warboys, because actually Warboys was arrested in relation to that crime. So he was identified in the taxi coming back. They were able to go and arrest him, and then he was interviewed by the police, and then they decided not to bother with conducting a Section 18 search because no taxi driver would ever risk losing his license, which was the sort of attitude. When questioned by our barrister, saying, "Look, did you follow principle number one, treat the victim's account as truthful?" He said, "Well, I had real concerns about the plausibility of her allegation. I was concerned about the level of drunkenness. I was concerned that she was alleging she'd accepted a drink and a tablet from a stranger, which I thought an educated girl at university was a strange thing to do. I was concerned that if she had done that willingly, then she could have taken drugs. I was concerned about the level of intoxication generally, and I was concerned about the CCTV that I saw, so the CCTV of them getting out of the car and her sort of staggering and all boys holding her and then her staggering in to college. I was concerned generally of the level of intoxication." That's why he felt that this was not likely to be a truthful account. I must say that was a very jaw-dropping moment for me in the trial because I thought, you know, these officers know. I mean, some of these officers have been disciplined and yet they still don't accept any responsibility. And I think the real challenge for the police, because there are some very good police officers out there specialising in this area, and I think they've really listened to practitioners and to victims about how to improve rape investigation. And if you look at the policies around drug-assisted sexual assault and around all the areas, they look to me like they're pretty good in practice. But if they are not translated onto the ground, and if there is no, you know, the failings were failings of training, failings of supervision. They were basically, these officers couldn't be asked. They didn't have any. They didn't care, you know. That something has to be done to make those those very good policies translate onto the ground.
Thank you. I think you'll all agree we've had four very, very impressive accounts and discussions. We've got very short time, about 12 minutes or so, but the So thank you. I should have said that first. Absolutely. The panelists have agreed to take some questions. So could you please keep any questions very short? Focus the question on points that have been raised this evening to keep the discussion focused tonight. If you could say who you are before you ask your question, and I'll take two or three together, and I suspect that will be all we'll really have time for. So where are they? Let's go at the back first.
Hi, my name is Nali Kabir, and I'm from the Gender Institute. I just wanted to find out a little bit about the kind of training that the police receive on issues around dealing with rape, and whether some of this kind of information will find its way into that training.
Thank you. At the back.
Thanks. Roger Grave, I'm a professor here at the LSE in Mannheim, and Martin very kindly name-checked my film of 1982. The reason I want to put this in a very interesting discussion indeed is about the excuses, not the excuses, the rationale back in 1982, and indeed Harriet's just mentioned, that in effect, if somebody's been drinking or in some way cooperates with what appears to cooperate, rather, with the rape, that there wouldn't be a chance of getting a conviction. And therefore, in that sense, the police officers, both in my film and subsequently, we made another film 20 years later, which showed how little had changed. We were just saying, look, this is really hard to get a conviction. Martin's point about it resting on the shoulders of the victim I thought was really interesting. But therefore, they're going to say, well, this isn't a reliable victim because they're vulnerable, as Betsy was illustrating very vividly, and therefore it's not worth a candle. You know, it's such a hassle anyway. We're just not going to do it. But it isn't just kind of prejudice against women. It's a kind of judgment call about whether it's worth the effort, if you see what I mean. It's sort of, it takes away the emotional responsibility because they can justify it to themselves. I just wondered what you guys thought about that.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Karen Darman from Media and Communications here at LSE.
Sorry, you probably need to speak up a bit.
Sorry. I agree that the conversation needs to be changed and that credibility consent have not served us well. But I'm a bit worried about the shift to vulnerability, especially with regards to, for instance, drug or alcohol consumption, as Harriet mentioned, that might still trigger the blame game, wherein, okay, because you've taken drugs or alcohol, you are considered vulnerable. But on the flip side, if you know that taking drugs or consuming alcohol makes you vulnerable, then you shouldn't have done it because you know that you might get raped. And it reminds me of the conversation about, what you wear might get you raped, or any other kind of. And again, it's not like burglary. You can't say don't leave your belongings on the front seat of your car and then your car won't get burgled. I'm worried that the vulnerability argument might lead us down that route. And so how do we stop that risk?
Thank you. There's one here. Like I say, I'll take two more and then I'll hand back to the panelists, and then I think we will have to finish. So one up there.
So you mentioned that 75% of rapes go unreported, and the ones that do are reported by people who are extremely vulnerable. I was just wondering if you had any comments on to why so many go unreported and sort of why that must be. Sorry, yeah.
Thank you. At the back there. I'm into the back, the lady, yes.
Thank you. It's just connected, actually, to what one of the ladies there was saying on a really good presentation, and I really enjoyed them. But on the vulnerabilities thing, I am conscious that we are in danger of focusing still always on the woman and the problems of the woman or the issues for the woman. It comes back to some degree of responsibility for her. And I think there's a piece of research that I'm always boasting and bragging about that I read that was done in, I think it was in Australia, which is survivors' insights into perpetrators' strategies. And it looks at all of these kinds of scenarios, and it has some 40-odd rape examples where the women are actually asked to reflect on what did the perpetrator do to get you into a position that he was able to basically rape you with impunity and take advantage of all of these assumptions and myths and blaming attitudes. And I think a lot of the things in that study reflect all of these issues, because ultimately what we're talking about is power and we're talking about patriarchy, and that's really the context that we should be having the debate in. And so I just felt that there might be more that we could do to actually, as well as looking at some, because you said it perfectly, Betsy, when you said they deliberately choose and exploit a vulnerability. It's not that she's vulnerable, it's that they have chosen to select somebody to take advantage of in that way, and that is about power. That's why it's not about consent. So it was just a reflection on whether there's more we can do to bring some of that sort of perpetrator strategy stuff into the picture. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, I was going to ask all of you now to respond to whichever of the questions, comments you would like to do so, and sort of probably just for 2 minutes each, if that would be... and thank you for your... yes, I'm sorry.
To go to the question of vulnerability, because I think that comes up quite a lot, the second thing that I said, which we have to do, is gear the investigation to exploitation and looking at exploitation. But I think unless we acknowledge, and I think, I studied sexual violence and physical violence for 25, 30 years before I went into the police service. I'm getting old now. And so I studied silence. Now what surprised me, and I, you know, it's hard to teach an old dog new tricks. What surprised me was the extent of vulnerability of the reported cases. And that should not be dismissed. We should acknowledge that. We should absolutely acknowledge that and say that is a brick wall. What do we do about it? And there's absolutely no way does that mean go down to a victim-blaming stance. But unless we acknowledge the fact that vulnerability is, I suggest, from reading lots of these things over time, targeted, exploited. Why is it that was recognized late in the Saville situation and not today? And I think there is something about looking back to say, oh, that's how it worked. But actually, those are the kinds of things that are being reported today. So I do consider it a dilemma. Because we have misogynist discourse, shouldn't mean we should shy away from what is happening. And that's where I am. At this point, I understand misogyny and victim blaming. But what I'm saying is that we should not silence then the data that tell us that that is exactly what's going on.
Thank you. I'll go straight along the line.
Okay. As far as training is concerned, I think the lady at the back there. There is a basic level of training that everyone gets. The SOIT officers that have been spoken about, who are the officers that deal directly with the victims, get a specific training program which is designed specifically to allow them to do that role, i.e. deal with the particular needs and vulnerabilities of victims of sexual offences, and then to actually understand and deal with that process and be able to do that in the multi-agency environment as well, because the point about the referral centres is really important, because that is about accessing medical, psychological counselling assistance for victims and trying to do what is a legalistic process of evidence gathering in the least threatening and impersonal kind of space that you can do that, and working on that. And we are also, we are currently just finishing nationally a piece of work which is about awareness training for all frontline and the person who might be the first police officer or member of staff that someone comes and reports to. And to pick up on really what's been said, where I've driven that is, when they first came to me, they came to me with something that was quite procedural, and what we've turned it into is something that's almost entirely behavioural, because the issue for that first person that someone walks into, I'm less worried they understand the process and more worried or more concerned that they understand the way they need to behave to allow that person to come into the process and then pass them on to a SOIT officer and into that system. So it's quite extensive training. You can always do more. Will it work with every individual officer and member of staff? No. And as I said at the very beginning, all of those are human beings who come with their own baggage around all of this in the way that we all do. So there is some big stuff there, I think, about that kind of debate. I think Roger's point about it's not going to go anywhere, effort. I don't think it's so much a lack of effort. There are obvious cases where that is apparent, and you filmed one and Harriet's talked about another. That is not the majority of cases. That's not the majority of the way things happen. I think it's that reality. And where we shifted, working with Keir Starmer when he was DPP and after all the Savile, and one of the things that we identified was in child cases where the lawyers in CPS who were deciding not to prosecute were not making bad decisions, but they were answering appropriately to the wrong questions. And the questions all got to the vulnerability and, if I can use that term, the inadequacy of the individual as a victim and a witness in a court case, instead of getting at what are all the attendant circumstances here, which does get you to that point around you're looking at the offender behaviour and not focusing entirely on what happened to the victim. And that, so, and we are trying to push to extend that into the adult arena as well, because I think it applies equally, without getting us into that dreadful territory where you're back into essentially, in a subtle way, blaming the victim in some way and getting you back into the kind of short skirts drinking and all of those horrible places we've been before. We've got to be careful not to end up there, but there is a reality that, as I said, they're chosen because there is something that makes the offender think that he is more likely to get away with it. And that's a reality that we've got to try and deal with. As far as unreported, I think many of the points that Betsy's made is why people don't come forward. So people are scared of the system, scared of coming forward to the police, see things and think it's going to be, they're not going to listen to me, they're not going to believe me. But I think it's the shame, it's not being sure about what happened and therefore mostly fearing you're not going to be believed or finding yourself in some sort of circumstance. We get information from those groups that we work closely with who support survivors and turn victims into survivors or support victims to become survivors. And so we have some information from there, but we need to get to understanding more about this. And I think some of that is about getting systems where we can have information given to us that's not necessarily dragging someone into the system. The problem is, if I sit as a cop and say that, then people will attack me and say, all you're trying to do is reduce the number of reported rapes. What I want to do is understand what is going on, make sure victims access support and the help they need. I want to know what's happening crime-wise, and then those that we can, we bring into the system and we allow them to get access to justice.
Thank you.
Louise.
Those have been fairly comprehensive as well. If we just pick up perhaps on something about the under-reporting, and just echo what Martin said, essentially, fear of the court process seems to be a key factor in the reluctance of rape complainants to come forward. It's not something we've particularly touched upon this evening, but it's still a case, as has been reported in numerous cases recently, that rape complainants often face a fairly brutal, hostile cross-examination if the cases do eventually reach court, and that is a significant deterrent, the research suggests, for many women in coming forward at all. Just to say something in terms of non-reporting by vulnerable victims and those with mental health difficulties, and one of the quite distressing things that you read about why victims don't come forward, a real fear of being disbelieved, a fear that they do report sexual victimisation, it may actually be misinterpreted as a sign of relapse, that it might actually have like devastating repercussions for them that involve hospitalisation, ultimately potentially section against their will. Some people don't come forward and report offences because they fear that those kinds of consequences that have all kinds of ramifications for the kinds of care that they receive, and also perhaps access to children, huge ramifications that can follow. So it's understandable that a significant number of women don't come forward. Fear of retaliation, action intimidation. There are many reasons. But fear of the court process and a real fear of not being believed are things that consistently come through from the research literature.
And Harriet, final word. If you want to take, you don't have to, but obviously give you the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, just on briefly on vulnerability, I think the reality is that probably most women are vulnerable. I mean, most of the women in the War Boys case were not in the vulnerable category, but they became vulnerable when they were drugged. And that the reality is that And you know, many, you know, when you say the research on mental health problems, are you talking about mental health before being raped or after being raped? Because we know that, you know, after being raped, you know, you're going to have a mental health problem, probably, unfortunately. Just on training, I don't think the War Boys case is an example that's an extreme example, like the case in 82 in Thames Valley. I mean, that was what was really shocking to me. I kind of partly bought the myth of Sapphire as some special gold standard police investigating unit, and that's what I was shocked about, that there was this image that you had these specialist trained officers, but I mentioned this, that why I was so shocked by hearing those officers giving evidence, because they, you know, there's something wrong in the culture of the police if they don't feel ashamed. If they don't feel ashamed that they made such a total cock-up of this. And I think until, you know, something has to translate. There are really good committed police, but if there are officers who are involved in investigating rape, who have the sort of attitudes that they had, you know, and that is of course reflected across society. They're only reflective of what a lot of people think in the world, and you know, obviously this is a much bigger question about education, about understanding, you know, rape and what it's about. But you know, something has to be done within the Met to actually make officers feel bad that they failed.
Unfortunately, we're already over time, which is a great shame, because I think there's a lot more that we could all say. But I'd like to finish by thanking yet again all four of our speakers.